In 1976, NASA landed two spacecraft on the surface of Mars. These were the Viking spacecraft. They also, as part of that effort, there were two orbiters that orbited Mars and took thousands of photographs. The lander took this photograph, one of the landers, and this is day 556. Those landers were remarkable. They operated for a couple of years, and that's well into the second year. We have an incredible amount of data about Mars from those two spacecraft. Most of what we know about Mars, we attribute to that to those remarkable accomplishments. Recently, we sent the Mars Observer there, and it didn't make it. That was about 3 years ago. So now we have launched, a few weeks ago, another spacecraft to Mars that will orbit Mars and take more pictures and do some more spectral studies. And we have, in fact, a lander that will be launched in a couple more weeks that will land on the surface of Mars. And it has a little rover that'll drive around and take pictures and do some chemistry and broadcast back the data. So it's an exciting time for Mars missions, although we were sincerely sorry that the Russian mission has failed. We hope that these two U.S. missions will provide new data. To get back to Viking, one of the disappointments of Viking was that although it had a lot of sophisticated instruments on board, it failed to detect any sign of life on Mars. There were no organics in the soil. There was no, they attempted to culture life, cellular life. Nothing happened. Absolutely negative results. So people more or less forgot about life on Mars for a long time after that. This is one of the Viking photos. Now, the thing about Mars is that from the photography, we see that Mars has craters like the Moon, but it also has a series of features related to water. This particular feature is the ejecta blanket from this crater, and it's called a rampart blanket because it has a fairly steep front. And the interpretation is that this crater, this impact, hit into ice, into permafrost, and melted the ice, and essentially this was a fluidized flow of ice and water and dirt, and at this point it froze again and simply froze into that pattern. So there's indirect evidence of this sort, plus models that say that there's probably a lot of ice on Mars underneath the surface. And the other thing about that, if there's ice and you go deeper because of the geothermal gradient, that is heat coming up from below, at some point you're into water. So there's a model for groundwater on Mars. Even though there's no water on the surface, there may be a lot of water in the ground. And that's key to our story. So just keep that in mind. All right. Our story begins, really, with an impact on the surface of Mars, a big impact of a comet or perhaps an asteroid, which blasted off some rocks from Mars, and this was thought not to be possible until we started finding Mars meteorites, and then the theorists went back to the drawing boards and figured out how this could happen with computer models. So this was blasted off into space, some rocks. Some of the rocks went into the sun eventually. The rock we're interested in was probably part of a bigger rock. And it wandered around in space for 16 million years. It was lost in space in a chaotic orbit for 16 million years. We know that accurately because of the cosmic ray effects on the rock chemistry. The chemistry has been measured, and the cosmic rays have built up over time a series of radioactive elements. And by measuring those, we know it's time and space. Well, this rock somehow came close enough to the Earth to get caught up in the Earth's gravitational pull, and it started falling through the atmosphere. It probably broke up into a lot of smaller rocks. 80% of them perhaps went into the ocean, because that's where 80% of the Earth is ocean. But a few of them, or at least one, fell in Antarctica. So what we see here is what happens when a meteorite falls in Antarctica. This is a cartoon showing a meteorite falls here on these blue ice areas, which are big ice sheets or ice flows, and they slowly move downhill from the South Pole toward the ocean, way over here somewhere. And as they move, anything that falls on the surface gets more or less sucked in, and then goes under the ice. And then if the ice meets an obstruction, like a mountain range, the flowage comes back to the surface, and the meteorite then is left on the surface as the wind evaporates the ice. So this is the basic process by which meteorites fall in Antarctica and they're recovered in Antarctica. And this was first realized about 15 years ago by the Japanese, and the U.S. Started sending expedition down there every year. Japanese do too. And they have brought back something like 10,000 meteorites from Antarctica now. It's been a real gold mine for meteorites. It has increased the world supply by about a factor of 10. Well, this is a typical summer day in Antarctica, and this is the U.S. expedition a few years ago, showing that they do have sometimes severe conditions even in the summer, but they go anyway. And this is what a meteorite looks like in the field. This is how they are. They're often on little pedestals here of ice, and the wind is blowing away the ice around them. Eventually it would fall down, and then another pedestal would erode. You see these every 1,000 meters or less sometimes. And 95% of the rocks that you see on the surface turn out to be meteorites rather than Antarctic rocks, because there's just no good way to get an Antarctic rock into this ice flow. These meteorites are collected by the field party, and they're brought back, and they're put in cabinets in Houston, and they're kept under nitrogen so they don't rust when they warm up into the Houston humidity. And so they try to keep them clean using techniques developed for the lunar samples. In 1979, one of these rocks, 79001, was recovered from Antarctica, and it was sliced open. Typically, these meteorites are sliced or chipped so that they can be identified. Well, this one, it turned out, when it was sliced open, had a lot of little black specks in it. And these black specks are impact glass. They're glass created by the impact in that painting, which blasted the rock, this particular rock, off of Mars. Now, what is interesting about that glass is that within that glass, there is trapped gas. And when that gas was analyzed, it became clear that gas, which was mostly carbon dioxide, and then had some nitrogen, and then had some of the rare gases here. This is the analysis of that, those little glass black things. And this, in fact, is the analysis of the Mars atmosphere as broadcast back in 1976 by Viking. And the air bars are about the size of these circles, so there's not much air in that curve. And so what we're seeing here is almost an exact match between this trapped glass, trapped gas in the glass in this meteorite and the composition of the Mars atmosphere. Now, there's nothing else in the inner solar system that has anything like this composition. Venus has a lot of CO2, but none of the other components fall on this kind of line. They're much different. Earth is of course, quite different. Nitrogen is much more abundant than CO2. So we know the atmosphere of Venus, and we know the atmosphere of Jupiter through Galileo, and we know the composition of the Mars atmosphere from Viking. And there's a very nice match here only for Mars. So that is, we call this the Rosetta Stone. That particular meteorite is the key to understanding and being certain that meteorites come here from Mars. Now, I'm sorry, this is dark. We're having a slide problem. But the other bit of evidence is that these are oxygen isotopes. And you don't have to worry about the details. But notice this line here. Those are all the Mars meteorites. It's a very tight family. Now, oxygen isotopes, the way it works is that they're allowed to move up and down this line through natural processes, but they can't get off that line. That line itself is determined by the original reservoir from which that oxygen came. In other words, the planet from which it came. This is the Earth down here. The Moon is about here. Carbonaceous chondrites are way off the page and so forth. So there is a tight group here of meteorites, numbering 12. Among that group is this Rosetta Stone that I talked about with the Mars gas in it. So the logic is that if that is from Mars, then the rest of these guys have to be from Mars as well. And that's the basic answer when people ask, how do we know these rocks are from Mars? It's a combination of those two kinds of analyses. There are other things, too. There's a lot more chemistry to bolster this argument, but this is the basic reason. Now, this is a summary of those Mars meteorites, 12 of them. The biggest one is Nakhla at 40 kilograms. The Allen Hills is the one I'm going to talk about. Mostly, it's about 2 kilograms, and about half of these were found in Antarctica. The other half were seen to fall from the sky all over the world, and were put into museums. This one, the Chassinet, was found in 1815. It fell out of the sky in France, and it was put in the Paris Museum. Nakhla, I think, fell in Egypt and killed a dog. That's the only fatality from a Mars meteorite so far. So that's a bunch of them.